The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski. It's summer, we're in a city, and so...
Hi, I'm Tyler Oakley. I have 5 million subscribers. I am from America, and YouTube is a game-changing platform.
Yes, the superstars of the YouTube community landed in London last weekend for the annual Summer in the City conference. We'll be talking with Guardian digital journalism reporter Fred McConnell about the power of YouTubers and why content creators like pop culture and queer politics commentator Tyler Oakley are pulling millions of loyal fans online from across the globe. Also this week, Google gets them while they're young. The Chromebook takes a big piece of the U.S. educational market. We take a ride to the top of the hype cycle curve and find three words: internet, of, and things, in that order. And a decade of The Guardian's games blog. Dang, what a decade in gaming it's been. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio this week are Charles Arthur, back from his sabbatical. Welcome back, Charles.
Hello.
Ah, it's nice to be reminded what your voice sounds like. Keith Stewart is also joining us. Hello. Keith.
Hi, hello.
It's nice to hear your voice as well, Keith. Thank you. Alex, how you doing?
All good.
And your voice sounds just the same as it always does, but delightful regardless. Now, if you've not been in a school lately, and I'm talking here about the last two or so decades, you wouldn't recognize it. Really, back when I were a lass, we had pens, colored pencils, paper, slide rules. Yes, we actually had slide rules, calculators, and possibly some big sticks that we were beaten with. I frankly can't exactly remember. It's all a bit of a blur. I first became aware of just how much has changed in primary education when I wrote a white paper about tech in the classroom in 2006. Then the hype was about interactive whiteboards, Palm Pilots, and the World Wide Web. Fast forward to now, even more. And the youth of today all have phones and increasingly school-issued tablets and netbooks. And while much attention has been on Apple's advances in this market, Charles, this week you wrote about another contender, the Google Chromebook.
Yes, this was some research from Gartner, which looks at all sorts of areas of the computing field. And they were forecasting that Chromebook sales for 2014 will hit a total of 5.2 million units. Now, that's not very big in the context of the overall PC market, which is about 310, 320 million worldwide. But the interesting thing was that they were saying that a lot of the take-up of Chromebooks, certainly in 2013, was in the education market. They reckoned about 82% of them, 2.9 million Chromebooks sold in all across the whole of 2013. So it's not the sort of the earthquake that people think it is. But a lot of those were in education. And the expectation is that Chromebooks are going to continue to make these sorts of moves into education because they're cheap, because they're easily configurable by an administrator. They have the sort of things that lots of people who make decisions about buying stuff like, such as keyboards and screens. So there's a sort of a shift happening in education there where Chromebooks are becoming more popular.
But where is this happening? This isn't in the UK, is it? The figures are from the US, I think?
Principally, this is all happening in the US because a lot of US education districts make decisions about buying things. And there's so much space basically in the States that there's always going to be a school district which is looking at doing some big buy. iPads have been one of the tools that have been looked at as a big potential replacement for Windows PCs out there, but now Chromebooks are also coming into contention. So if you start searching around on the web for educators talking about, well, should it be the Google Chromebook, should it be the iPad, then you'll find loads and loads of discussion about this. There really is a very hot topic in the whole education computing space.
And why is that? I mean, what are the varying benefits of each? In some ways, I kind of see it as VHS versus Betamax, and in some ways one is quite open, the other one is quite locked down. Is that, for example, a factor in a decision making purchase?
Don't know really. It depends what you think is the open one. I mean, it tends to be around whether people are thinking that iPads are good for some functions that are less good for others, where, say, you need a fixed keyboard. Chromebooks, you know, are not going to be very good for touch-based things unless you go for the really expensive touch-based ones. But they do have a keyboard attached, generally. And they are easy to administer, and you know, any kid can use them. So, I mean, my suspicion, though I haven't looked into the details here, is that in a lot of cases, it's going to be primary schools or their equivalent, the sort of early years, the sort of 5 to 13 or so, which will be buying the iPads because those provide lots of app-based ways that kids can learn. Whereas for the older kids, where they're much more into the sort of the functional sort of computing, where keyboards become more important, that you're going to see Chromebooks being more popular.
You mentioned in the article, or actually I think it was somebody who you interviewed in the article that you wrote this week in The Guardian, that this shows how the market in netbooks is being carved up. What does this? What does the display at the carvery say, Charles?
So I contacted Horace Dedieu, who runs the Asimco consultancy, who tends to look at these things not as, oh, this is a Windows computer, this is a Chromebook, this is, you know, he doesn't look at what the titles are. He prefers to cut these things down into jobs to be done. And his question is, well, what is the job to be done in education? What is it actually you're trying to carry out? And so he says, you know, what's happening here is that Chromebooks, he says, will gain a large share of browser-only interaction where user input is important, hence school and work. The iPad, he says, will gain a large share of app usage with some shopping media consumption thrown in. Android tablets, good for video like YouTube and, you know, content like games, perhaps. Phones for comms and apps, traditional PCs for productivity. And it's much more about segmenting down how, you know, where, what's the best device for this task that you want to carry out, rather than, oh, I've got, you know, 100 million PCs, therefore, you know, the PC is sort of the essential thing for schools or for, you know, watching video on. It's actually much more about tools for the job rather than sort of saying, well, this is how we've always done it.
Very interesting. Well, for more on this story, you can read Charles's article on theguardian.com/technology. Aside for the fashion industry and maybe craft beer, technology is one of the parts of our global culture and economy that's prone to explosions of hype. Now, I have two words for you people. Internet, fridge. That kind of sums it up, really, doesn't it? Analyst firm Gartner's annual hype cycle captures the fluctuation in tech trends, graphing the journey of technologies from sneak peek at out there stage to full-blown acceptance and usefulness. This week, Alex, you wrote about where the Internet of Things is on Gartner's hype cycle, and it appears that alarms are going off. First of all, tell me what the hype cycle is, because I don't know if they're sort of having a laugh with it or what's going on here.
If it is a joke, it's quite a long running one. The hype cycle is an annual event at Gartner, and it's one of their primary ways of looking at the tech sector as a whole. Basically, it says that new technologies as they're introduced to the market generally hit a peak where everyone thinks they will solve everything, they will be the biggest thing in the world. That peak comes several years before they're actually useful at all and is much, much higher than the actual outcome that you see. So, for instance, right now, Gartner says that one thing that is coming out of this cycle and heading into what they call the plateau of productivity is speech recognition. And it's very easy to look back and see the hype cycle for that. Years back, it was sci-fi only. Then actual speech recognition starts to be developed in labs. News trickles out, and it's what they call the innovation trigger. Everyone starts going, oh my God, this could actually be a thing. Then the news of that innovation grows and grows and grows until you hit the peak of inflated expectations, where essentially people are saying speech recognition is everything. There will be no technology that doesn't recognize you. You will be having conversations with your microwave. And then what happens?
And your fridge.
And then what happens is the bubble bursts and the technology actually starts making it onto the market and people have the ability to interact with it for the first time and they find that the hype is vastly overblown. That you can speak to some things badly and it's nowhere near as good. And so they have disillusionment. And
actually, the trough of disillusionment is a brilliant, brilliant expression that they use in this art, in this diagram, isn't it?
The trough of disillusionment. It is just as important as the idea of the hype in the first place, because what it says is that actually just before a technology hits the market, if it is one of these major technologies that does change a sector, we'll actually think it's worse than it's going to be. Speech recognition a year or 2 years ago, just before Siri hit the market, if Siri is the example of the thing that takes it mainstream, speech recognition was a joke. It was shouting down the phone at a terrible customer service thing, which asks you yes or no, and then can't even understand that. So there is this period in which a new technology hits the market, destroys its own image, and then gradually builds it back up until you hit the plateau of productivity.
Okay, so here we have, you know, we've seen the Internet of Things moving from the kind of the innovation trigger, and it's climbed up to the top of the hype cycle. Does that mean that we're going to become disillusioned with it in the next few years? I mean, it's yeah. kind of difficult to sort of see what the... it's quite an elastic time period.
This is Gartner's broad prediction. Yeah, Gartner say that it'll take 5 to 10 years for the Internet of Things to hit this plateau of productivity, this period when it's actually being used sensibly, well, and without hype. And before then, we are going to get disillusioned with it. And it's not hard to see why. Currently, the Internet of Things exists in a very few sparse products which have potential and are useful, and people who have Nest thermostats and smoke alarms,
I have one,
speak highly of them.
It did shout at me today when I tried to make some rice.
And they speak highly back.
exactly.
But at the same time, it's being posited as a world-changing thing. If you spend any time at all in tech business circles, we are told daily that there will soon be billions of internet-connected devices which will all speak to each other seamlessly, fluidly. That might happen one day, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. And if you seriously buy into it, you're going to be disappointed. Because as Gartner highlights, there's a whole ton of problems in the way.
Well, exactly. And so this trough of disillusionment is in fact quite a useful period in which the society comes to terms with what it actually means.
Right.
Because there is the ethical implications of having your thermostat, you know, talking to you and talking to your lights and talking to your dog and talking to your washing machine and, of course, your fridge. So there are certain things that we need to figure out. We need to figure out privacy issues. There's all kinds of stuff that we need to figure out. So it's actually quite useful to have this trough, isn't it?
And it's also useful to have it after it's come to market. If you think of the way tech firms would like things to happen, they would like just a steady, steady growth in how it works. They don't want any trough. But what's kind of useful is the ability to put something out there, have it spread slightly, fail, and then a period of retrenchment where problems that would otherwise be baked in from the very start can actually be sorted out. And the second wave, hopefully, is then better than it would otherwise have been.
Charles?
So my question is there a consistent time period over which these things happen, or is it just takes as long as it takes?
I mean, for Gartner, it takes as long as it takes. You've got some things where they're saying this is coming out of the trough of disillusionment, but it's still going to take 5 to 10 years to be sorted. Other things which they're saying haven't even reached the peak of hype, but will actually be on the market in the next 5 years. The part of that is, you know, just you can't predict it, and they don't want to put too strong a prediction on it. But it's also virtual reality is a great example. Virtual reality is something which they say is heading towards the plateau of productivity slowly, but it's on its way out of the trough of disillusionment. But it's very easy to see how virtual reality has been in that trough for the better part of two decades.
This
is a technology where the hype was almost 30 years ago now. But the fall after that was so hard and so damaging to the image of virtual reality that work on it almost stopped for the better part of 20 years. And it's only now that this period of retrenchment is over and there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, that's a good example, actually, of something that may actually come out of the trough. But surely there are others that reached, you know, dizzying heights of this peak that hit such lows in the trench that there's no way they'll ever come out.
There's some things which were just empty. They weren't hype, they were pure bubbles. But by and large, Gartner are pointing to technologies which do have a use, which do have a concept, which if they can be sorted out, will be useful. It's notable, for instance, you know, cold fusion isn't on there because they don't expect it to happen. Also, Bitcoin isn't something that they look at because Bitcoin isn't a technology in this sense. It's not something which will which is a problem that will inevitably be solved and come out the other end. The things they're looking at are human augmentation, brain-computer interface. These are the things that they put as 10, 20, 30 years away.
It's real sort of, it's the futurism it's, stuff, it's isn't futurism. It? It's, you know, where the 3D printers of today, you know, will be printing themselves
exactly.
And printing the armies of the drones and the robots that and
fold.
Where
are 3D
stuff.
Printers on it?
Well, that I was just about to say, they're very careful to split 3D printers in two. On the one hand, they have enterprise 3D printing, which is, they're saying, very close to being in this productive end stage, because enterprise 3D printing is businesses having a 3D printer and printing stuff for customers. It's basically a radical rehaul of the manufacturing process. It's you buy your shoes, but as well as being able to customize the colors, you can also customize the insoles so it matches your foot. It's a very obvious extension of what we have right now. Consumer 3D printing is one of the most overhyped technologies they see on the whole thing. It's third or fourth place after Internet of Things and wearable user interfaces. So consumer 3D printing, they're saying, we're all going to get very, very disappointed before we eventually get it in our house.
Well, they've managed to come out with this for a significant period of time, a certain number of years that Gartner's been coming out with this. So they themselves aren't overhyping themselves. I mean, it's interesting that they are throwing themselves into this market, that they're putting themselves in out there. So for more on this, go to theguardian.com/technology and track at Alex Hearn on Twitter to get him on next year's hype cycle. Earlier this week, Keith Stewart, our Guardian Games editor, raised an important anniversary on Twitter. He announced, and Keith, you get to tell the people.
It's the 10th anniversary of the Guardian Games blog.
That is right. Yes. 10 years ago, before this podcast was a twinkle in the Guardian's eye, there were three people who were given the gaming gauntlet to wave at Guardian readers. That was you and Greg Howson and me, and it was quite a gauntlet, was it not?
It was, yeah. I'd done a few pieces for the Guardian before on like mobile phones and mobile phone games, and then suddenly got a call from Neil McIntosh, who I think was their head of blogging at the time, and also Kevin Anderson. And I ended up in that old office in Farringdon.
That's right, with the cigarettes. There were still sort of ashtrays, brass ashtrays in the toilets. Proper old school hack stuff. Well, now that 10 years have passed in what feels like an instant, and Keith, only you are left holding up the fort, or should I say, shooting at the fort? Let's take a brief look back at some of the highlights of the last decade of computer games. Can you remember your very first post?
I was trying to find it this morning and I can't. I think we did a sort of a vague welcome to games blog and set out our agenda to sort of take the culture of games seriously. And I think we spent 2 years just blogging silly stories that we found that morning.
My first one was about a sort of a rape horror game called Sociolatron. So I decided that I was going to set my stake out.
And somehow that's not turned into a brand which has lasted 10 years.
So. But it does still exist. I found it the other day.
One thing I did do though was I went through the stats and found some of the biggest stories we've done, some of the ones that have got the biggest page views over the last 10 years. And the one at the top, despite our kind of agenda to sort of seek out the most mysterious and strange and odd independent games that we could find, the biggest story we've ever done until this date was FIFA 12, the 10 players you must buy in career mode. It's real Charles, Woodward and Bernstein stuff there from me.
I remember actually when you came on board at The Guardian, you were very closely involved with the games blog as well, and we would get together and look at the stats. And there were certain posts that really felt like we needed to do more, because we were interested in the stats, just even finding out, getting feedback. Because often it just felt like we were blogging into oblivion. And so there were I certainly recall when I was still working on the games blog, that there were ones that really started to stand out. Things like the Xbox 360 versus the PlayStation, PlayStation 2, I think it was even at that time. You saw the evolution of the games blog and sort of what it was that we were trying to do. Do you see any trends? Has anything kind of risen out of the mist over the last 10 years about the trends in computer gaming and how The Guardian's covered them?
The giant trend Well, no, there are two giant trends actually. So for the sort of for the hardcore gaming, the big trend is the move to things like Steam and, you know, non-packaged games. So, you know, the shift to downloadable, to people not going into a shop to buy a game, but people just sort of, yeah, I'll download it. There you go. That's one really big change. And the other one, of course, is the whole rise of smartphones and those as gaming platforms, which I think poses a far greater threat to Nintendo and the Wii U, really, and 3DS and the handhelds. I mean, you know, you look at what Sony's done with the PS Vita. They said, yeah, okay, we give up. That's the other thing which is shifting. You know, casual gaming, you know, back in sort of 2005-06, people saying, oh, casual gaming, yeah, because that was what Nintendo had gone for with the Wii, which I think actually the Wii was a fantastic casual gaming console. It was just absolutely apex, you know, perfect for the time, perfect in every way. But then you get the smartphone revolution, people are playing on their handhelds, they're sort of playing casual games at any old time of day, more hours probably spent on Candy Crush or something than has ever been spent on Call of Duty. And the question is, is there a meeting between those two things, between the hardcore gamers who have a big console sitting in the corner and the people who are just doing it on their handhelds?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there's a lot of confluence now, because I think the thing that connects both of those, of what you're talking about, was the idea of digital distribution has kind of democratized games now. So, and that, you know, a big part of that was iPhone introducing the App Store, making it very easy for people to download games, and then Steam, the sort of PC version of an App Store came out, and suddenly it was very easy for people to make and distribute games alone in small teams, which kind of widened the breadth of what we saw in games. So we moved away from the classic big boxed blockbuster games, the big kind of core things like Call of Duty, and the industry could embrace other things. So I think, you know, in some ways it's kind of wrong to see this dichotomy between casual gaming and hardcore gaming, because I think the democratization of the distribution of games has changed, and it's widened the audience. Like, we have this enormous audience for games now that's wider than it's ever been. I mean, if you look at the statistics, something like 48% of gamers are female, and I think something like 40-50% of over 50s play games now. So,
when you say gamers, yeah, do you mean players, people with consoles?
Yeah,
or do you mean exactly someone who at some point, you know, uses a play something from, you know, King or whatever?
Yeah, I think this is the challenge, actually, looking back. So 10 years ago, 2003, right, 2004, she says, quickly doing math in her head.
Brilliant, well done.
Yeah, thank you very much. But, you know, looking back at 2004, this was also before social networking really kicked off. So we also have the sort of browser-based casual. And the statistics that you're quoting there about, say, for example, 48% women, we were sort of banging that drum even at the time. I remember I was banging that drum even at the time when the ESA, the Software Association in the US, was saying 35% of gamers are women. And in fact, does that not have to do with the shift in what the definition of game and gamer is over the last 10 years?
Yeah, absolutely. I think games have become much more pervasive and habitual. And yeah, I mean, a lot of people within the specialist games press now really try and avoid the term gamer. I've accidentally used it because I've been writing about games for 20 years and I can't stop myself. But I think, you know, you don't talk about a television viewer as a televisioner. You have film buffs, but most people will use the cinema in a habitual way without thinking of themselves in that way. So I think games are now a pervasive medium. And I think if you look at the next generation, what marketers are calling Generation Z, I think interactive media like games are their primary source of entertainment. I think linear media is on the way out.
And yet I feel that this generation of consoles, the PlayStation 4, the Xbox One, I mean, I suspect those are possibly the last you'll see. I mean, they're going to see fewer sales than the previous generation.
Yeah, it's different. I would say, it would surprise me if there was another, in some ways, it would surprise me if there was another console generation. These ones are doing okay. Like, the PlayStation has, I think, is heading towards 10 million units now, much, much faster even than the PlayStation 2. So there is a market out there. But yeah, I am sure there's an interest and a desperation to look at the PC as a platform and think, well, can we make these things modular and more I don't know, more firmware updatable rather than bringing out these massive chunks of plastic every sort of 8 to 10 years.
All right, then we did a little bit of futurism earlier in the program, looking at the hype cycle. Let's do a little bit now. It's quite awesome to be able to have a stake in the ground. We've been covering games for 10 years. Well, I say we. You've been covering games for 10 years for the
Guardian.
Games
blog has been going. The games coverage has been going on longer than that.
Absolutely, yeah, but yeah. The games blog has been covering games for 10 years. What do you imagine? Let's not do 10 years from hence, but let's do say 5 years. What do you think of all of these things? Will continue.
I think what we're going to see more is a big thing in games at the moment is procedurally generated content. So you see games like Minecraft that procedurally generate their worlds for you, and they're different every time. And I think we're going to see that transferring to stories, and I think things are going to be much more personal. So we're going to see procedurally generated narratives, I think. So instead of just getting a landscape that creates for you at the start of the game, I think we're going to start seeing stories which react to you personally as a player and change and modify as they go along. And there's already research into procedurally generated narratives throughout the industry and universities around the world. I think there's a very interesting idea that's happening where games are actually going to start watching how you play as a person and changing the game accordingly, not just making it harder or more easy, but thinking, okay, this person obviously likes to drive around in cars and shoot stuff, so from now on we're going to make the missions just about that. So I think that's a big thing that's going to see, you know, personally based narratives in games. That's going to be huge. But also I think stuff like biometric inputs might well become bigger. So Kinect, not just filming your arms waving around, but maybe looking at you know, it can analyze body heat and check your heart rate. And I think we're going to see lots more of that sort of thing. So we're going to see our bodies and ourselves represented in games a lot more. I think that's interesting and kind of frightening.
Well, you can catch up with the games blog for daily games news, but you can also look back over the last 10 years at the library and the archive of course, the greatest gaming news in the history of the universe. Thank you very much to Keith, to Alex, and to Charles for coming in and jabbering around the round table here at Tech Weekly.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
Last weekend, London's Alexander Palace was taken over by the YouTube community as the Summer in the City conference brought content creators, consumers, and a myriad of other groups under one roof. And when that happens, the roof is usually blown off. Braving the screaming hordes of teenage fans, The Guardian's Fred McConnell went along to cover it for us, and Fred joins me now. Welcome to the Tech Weekly, Fred.
Thank you, Alex.
To the Tech Weekly. We've just upgraded it because you came in the room. So, Fred, who was there? What was, first of all, paint me a picture, right? What was Summer in the City?
I suppose it's somewhere between a festival and a convention. It feels like a festival because of the hordes of screaming girls, but it's a convention because there's also a lot of creators there and a lot of people that are passionate about making videos.
And so basically you've got the screaming girls coming to see, I'm assuming it's not coming to see the, you know, the bods at YouTube. They're coming to see, you know, the people that they watch on YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be fair, there were some screaming boys as well.
Fair enough, absolutely.
And there is some interesting crossover. You know, the organizer is originally a YouTuber, I suppose, and he still has his own channel, but now he is the organizer of the event. A very young guy called Tom Burns, who started by inviting, I think, about 60 people to a field in 2006.
And now look how it's evolved. So this actually isn't organized by YouTube. This is a thing that's completely user generated, like YouTube itself.
Indeed, and I think a couple of years ago, YouTube came in and started sponsoring it as one of several sponsors. But yeah, it's definitely still a kind of creator generated, and it's definitely feels like that. You know, it sort of feels like a big party. It's quite anarchic inside.
And tell me about some of the characters, some of the people that you met, the content creators.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess like most of them were what people would think of as vloggers. So they're sort of attractive young people. There's Zoella, who does a lot of beauty and shopping videos, I think. And then her boyfriend, Alfie Days, who has a huge vlogging channel. I think he's about 2.7 million subscribers. So they're known collectively as Zalfie, obviously. And then there was Tyler Oakley from America, who just yesterday reached 5 million subscribers. So he's probably the biggest name there. But then there was hordes of kind of mid-level vloggers, many of whom I've never seen, but there were sort of impromptu signing queues springing up all over the place. There were the official signing queues, which people were queuing for hours and hours and hours for, and then later in the day there were just kind of random groups of girls gathering around their favorite vlogger.
I don't suppose, and this is a totally random question, I don't suppose that there were any of the superstars of that. I can't remember exactly what it's called, the community in which people talk a bit like that.
Oh.
I called it.
Yeah, I don't think there were.
There weren't any people. No. Like that. I'd love to meet one of them.
You know, it's maybe some of the vloggers do that as a sideline. Maybe they have like a second channel for
apparently
that.
It's really, really popular.
Definitely.
I've got to find out more about this. It's absolutely fascinating. Well, anyway, you spoke with several people at the event. Who is the first person that we're going to hear from?
He's called Ben McCohen-Wilson, and he, in a way, is a kind of voice of authority. You know, he was seemingly the only person there over the age of 25. And his official title is the Director of Content Partnerships for YouTube in Northern and Central Europe. So we wanted to speak to him just to get an idea of more from the business angle, like what's in it for YouTube and why they put so much effort into helping the event happen now.
Although YouTube's present at all of these events, whether it's VidCon in America or Video Days in Germany, which is next weekend in Cologne, double the size of Summer in the City, 16,000, 16,500 we're expecting next week. All of these events are originated by the creators and organized by the creators. There isn't a house view at YouTube as to what content is going to be most successful in 12 months or we should be pushing more of in 12 months from now on the platform. There isn't a house view on exactly how this event ought to be run. We try and offer support in terms of organising. We sponsor the event to give them funding to help. But beyond that, it's not that there is a particular direction that we're trying to push the event. And the clearest way for that to be visible to people is for it not to be our event. No, we're a platform. And you know, from the very, very earliest days, all the way through to now, our goal is always just to be the place where it will always be easiest for anyone on the planet to share a video with anybody else on the planet.
Now, it's not just the US folks that we often hear about who are making it big on YouTube. Although you did speak with superstar Tyler Oakley, you also spoke with Sorted Food, who's a group of British foodies. And we'll hear from Tyler in just a second. But first, tell me a little bit more about Sorted Food. I'm a foodie, so I'm very interested in this bit.
Well, they're very interesting because they were one of the very few channel representatives there who aren't vloggers, although they do have a kind of a vloggy element to their channel because obviously that's what YouTube is about, that kind of intimacy. But yeah, I mean, they are similar in a way you could call them YouTube's answer to Jamie Oliver. He has his own channels, obviously, but they are very imaginative with the recipes they do. There's a very playful element. It's similar to an American channel called Epic Meal Time, but with a very British sensibility. So, but also it definitely would appeal to, you know, grown-up cooks. I know that my stepdad has used their recipes, so they're very universal and they're sort of, you know, the kind of boys you'd take home to your mum.
It's also interesting as well that they mention, actually, in what we're about to hear, that this is just one of their channels. Mm-hmm. So this is part of their kind of media panoply, as it were. They have an app. They do, you know, they do other things.
Yeah.
Is this something in terms of the trends of how people are using YouTube? Mm-hmm. Is this something that we're seeing people become more sophisticated around?
I think definitely. And there is that sense of people perhaps being a bit cagey about not wanting to reveal just how professional it is behind the scenes. I mean, a lot of these vloggers, people like Zoella and Alfie, have agents. They're part of networks. You know, if you want to speak to them, you have to go through their management. And when there was on the Friday of Summer in the City, it was an industry kind of oriented day. And then a couple of the Sorted Food guys were there and they just had a different vibe about them. You know, they had smarter shirts on, they had backpacks, they were there to network. And then on the Saturday, it was all kind of happy, smiley, meet the fans time.
Well, let's meet Sorted Food.
And we're Sorted Food, and I'm Barry.
I'm Ben.
I'm Jamie.
And I'm Mike.
Cool. So what is your question?
I'm Jamie.
I think, so Jerry
had to think about it.
A bit of AQI.
Sorted Food's a cooking channel. So we're a big global community of people who have a passion for food, want to learn more about cooking, but also have a bit of fun along the way as well. We try not to take it too seriously, just try and get people into the kitchen cooking food.
Who makes up your audience? Is it sort of younger people, or is it sort of like older than most YouTube channels would attract?
It's a real mix, yeah. And it's right across the world as well. But I mean, it started, we were students at the time, it's very student-centric. Now it's like grown into, it's young professionals, young graduates, young families, basically anyone who's looking for really simple food.
Yeah. Have you guys ever been approached by any sort of more traditional media? Like, have you ever had any TV companies coming along and saying, do you want to take this onto TV?
Yeah, but every time it's to their framework. We've built what we've built online because of our community. And if our community ain't there, then it's hard for us to kind of get into it. We need to find the right piece of work to work on, really, on a different platform. But at the moment, YouTube's our home. We want to be anywhere else, really.
But have you ever then seen any of the more traditional media sort of, not stealing your ideas, but have you ever looked at some of the sort of programs that come onto TV and go, hang on, we were doing that on YouTube?
Yeah, we've seen a couple of cooking shows put cameras in fridges, which we definitely started, and things like that. And you kind of see a few bits and pieces and you start to question it.
It's kind of a compliment, really.
It is a compliment, yeah.
It's never going to be the same because there's a man in the middle. With us, it's just us, a camera and an audience. There's no one producing it. We just kind of talk. We say what's on our minds. We share that with community, and there's no one can lose a job over it. It's just a bit of fun.
And more about this weekend now, like what do you guys actually get out of this weekend? Because, I mean, obviously the people who are here want to see you, but what do you get out of it?
I mean, we spend all day, every day, talking to people online, and whether it's on YouTube or Twitter or Facebook or our new app, and we're talking to them, but it's very difficult to put a face to the name. And suddenly when you see people in real life and they're coming up to you and you can see the passion that they've got for food and for cooking, they're showing you the photos on their phone of what they were cooking up last week, which was one of our recipes or a recipe they found through our new app and things like that. You know, that is really exciting, and it kind of really spurs you on to go out and do more of what we're already doing and try and make it bigger and try and affect more people.
Brands can never have, to an extent, because brands look at their audience's numbers and data. For us, we see food coming through to our channel all the time and seeing our recipes being made around the world. And as soon as you come and meet these people, you realise exactly what it means to them and how it actually has changed their life to some extent. And it's kind of why we do what we do, really.
That was Sorted Food. Now, Fred, you also spoke with Tyler Oakley. We've mentioned him, I think this is the third time we're mentioning him. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, he's just huge. I mean, he's definitely on the level of a legitimate superstar now. He just won two Teen Choice Awards this past weekend, which is obviously very mainstream. And I remember him when he was vlogging in his bedroom still at Michigan University 3 or 4 years ago. He was part of a collaboration channel and has since gone on to become a personality in his own right. And he does a lot of pop culture stuff, but he's also prominent advocate for LGBT rights and equality. And he was a member of several panels that weekend. It was really interesting to see him interacting with a younger vlogger who from the UK called Alex Bertie, who's trans. They were both on the panel together, showing that, you know, you had these big names, but you also had smaller names who nevertheless have very big influence over their particular audiences. So seeing those sorts of people come together was really interesting.
Well, the LGBT panel was obviously an important part of the conference, of his participation at the conference. So let's hear a little bit more from Tyler Oakley.
Well, I came out when I was 14, and so then I started YouTube when I was 18, so I was pretty comfortable in who I was, but it was kind of the opposite side of it. So I joined YouTube, and then I started to receive messages from people saying, thank you so much, you helped me come out, or thank you so much, instead of killing myself, I watched your videos all night. And like that was something I never thought was a thing or knew was a possibility through YouTube, and so those are always the messages that keep me like, wow, I have a great, amazing job that actually does something of substance, and I have the opportunity to use it for good. Every day I should.
So just describe to us what just happened in there and why that's important to you.
I just got done with, I think, an hour and a half or 2 hour signing, where I got to meet hundreds of very excited people, ranging all ages, from all over the UK. And to me, it's just, as an American YouTuber, you never fathom that you can go to another country and find people who believe in you or have been impacted by you in some capacity. It doesn't have to be like life-changing, but you were there for them at some point in their life when they needed it. And to meet those people and to hear their stories and to put faces to numbers that sometimes become monotonous to a lot of YouTubers is the most refreshing and humbling and just like warm feeling. So yeah, I try to go to as many conventions as I can. This year I went to like a million. I went to like Singapore and Sydney and Italy and London and LA and New York and just as many as I can, because those are the people that make my life worthwhile and like my job worthwhile.
And does it differ from country to country? Are the fans different?
Yeah. Every country has their own. You start to realize like there's different like cultural things, but I think the general consensus is they can never believe that a YouTuber would come to where they are. And I guess that's kind of a uniting thing for everyone, is that not many traditional celebrities go to their towns and do a meetup. Like, that's not a thing that happens. And so for YouTubers to come, they're just really gracious and thankful, and they just want to say thank you. And like, that's all I could ever ask for. So it's a great feeling.
It was incredible to watch them, you know, when you put your finger up, just to cut, and they genuinely respond. Well, because like instantly
they can get really excited, but if I want to say something, if I go like that, they'll all like shh, because they want, and half of them are recording it, so they're trying to get like the footage.
And they're used to listening to you.
Yeah, know,
that's kind of how you interact on YouTube, right?
Yeah, and the coolest thing about like a convention or something like that, like a gathering, is that what sometimes feels like a one-way communicator, even though we have comments and we have tweets and stuff like that, it sometimes can get a little bit like one-sided. So to come here and to have actual conversation with people who comment, but I might not necessarily see their comment every time, is game-changing for, I guess, me career-wise, because it's like, it reminds me of, these are people who have their own stories, who should be making YouTube videos themselves, and so it makes me want to inspire them to join, it makes me want to encourage them to be themselves, and hopefully they'll be on the stage next year.
That was Tyler Oakley, and before that we heard from Sorted Food, and before that, Ben McCowan-Wilson. And thank you very much, Fred, both for coming in, also for representing at Summer in the City. That was fantastic. To see Fred McConnell's video reports from Summer in the City, go to theguardian.com/video. That's all we have for you this week. We'll be back next Wednesday for our last show of the season. And we'll be taking a month off to recuperate and add to our freckle count. I'm Alex Kratosky, and Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. From all the team, thanks for listening. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.